Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddham dhammam sangham namassami. Does anyone have any questions so far? Or so, not so far? Anything come up that is burning your little heart? Anuma, yeah?
Feel awareness when you say. I always, if it's a doubt in my mind or I'm not quite sure, is there a perception when, like awareness when you say, but is there always perception?
Perception's always a part of conscious moment. So the five khandhas are always functioning.
Yeah.
And so your question is?
So does it paint the pure awareness that you call?
No.
No?
Like, because awareness has no quality.
Mm-hmm.
And qualities come and go. So you can feel angry and still know that it's anger. So the problem is always attachment. Not the anger. So when you like, you know, taking something that you're skilled at, you know, some things we're not skilled at, we get overwhelmed by them, but there's some things, you know, we kind of know it. Oh, that's just jealousy, or that's just anger. You just really know it, and your mind rests at ease with the negativity that's coming through consciousness, but you just know it so well, it's not a problem. You see, oh, it's just old stuff, or you just know it clearly. Other things, you get kind of, they're more powerful, you get confused by them. And that confusion is what you're always working with, and that's the attachment. So pure awareness, you can't figure that out. You can only trust in awareness of change. And then when the mind brings up, like, am I doing it right or not? If you see that as a sankhara, a mental formation, which has a certain doubt in it, whatever, as just a mental formation, and you stay with change, then it arises, ceases, it's not a problem. But if something like that comes up, and then you just start to get caught in the thinking mind, the questioning mind, and you get a lot of very, you know, you can read very complex things about that, and then you take those complex things and you start to think them through and so on and so forth, you can be very much in the mental realms, which is sankhara. There's nothing wrong with that. And you can discuss things with people and so on. But the point of the teaching is not to get the perfect sankhara, not to get the perfect mental formation, because that doesn't exist. All mental formations are imperfect, or anicca dukkha anatta, right? So that's the challenge of intellect, is what Ajahn Tanisro has a very good book called Skillful Questions. Right? So that we can ask, and the joke I always did, it's not a joke, it's serious. A woman came to me in Wellington and asked, she was going to a conference on Buddhism and evolution or something, or religion and evolution, and she said, does Buddhism prove or disprove the Darwinian theory of evolution? And I said, give me a break. What does it matter? And so you can, you know, one can ask all manner of questions. So the skillful question is always around Four Noble Truths, and then the inquiry is around tanha, attachment, how that works, and that's more and more subtlety that comes up around that. So the questions around ultimate truths, pure awareness, the unconditioned, is the unconditioned pure awareness, is that deathless, does it come and go, those kinds of questions, you can have a debate about it and so on, but the only way you can really figure it out is by sustaining awareness of change for long periods of time. And that's hard to do. That's very hard to do. So when we talk about, say, samadhi, if you define samadhi as something you have to attain, you know, so you read about these different levels of concentration, and you look at it and you throw your, you know, I can't do that. You get very kind of afraid or judgmental. I can't get this or get that. But if you look at, if you just understand, okay, what's the purpose of samadhi is to liberate your mind, and you just take it very simply that awareness of change is what the Buddha is recommending, or anicca dukkha, any of the three characteristics. Yeah? So we had the chant about anatta, but I've been teaching around anicca, and you take that as the norm. That's what you're trying to sustain. You need faith in that. All right? If you don't have faith in that, and you look at that, you say, yeah, but what about all those levels of concentration? I need to get those, right? But why do you need to get them? You need to get them to do that, maybe. So you need some sadha, you need conviction that might be profitable. And then you try to do it, and then you fail. You know, you get restless or whatever. And then you start to figure out, okay, what is it about my mind that can't sustain this presence for long periods of time? Because that's what we're trying to do, and that's samadhi. And then you look at the text and they say the hindrances, first of all. And the hindrances are, like I was saying this afternoon, I said there's energy, dullness and sleepiness. So you've got a challenge with sleepiness, right? That's one of your great challenges, your energy system. Attraction and repulsion and doubt. And those are they're all khandhas. You know, energy is a kind of khanda formations. Attraction and repulsion are khandhas, they're objects, they're operating. And doubt is around thought. That's always a khanda. So the inability to know that, like, these as just khandhas is where you lose the capacity to know anicca. So you start to work with attraction, repulsion. So the way I work with that, and I'm just going over what I said earlier, but I talked out, so why not? So what I said earlier in the afternoon session, the way I work with the hindrances is I get language which coaches me, reminds me of insights I've already had. That's how I try to use language, rather than just analytical language. Sure, analytical language I have used a lot in terms of trying to understand dependent origination, four noble truths, and so on. But after a while, you don't have to figure it out. You understand it. And then you use language more as suggestion. Like a coach says to you, just now, you know, you hit the ball in a different way. Put more shoulder into it or whatever. Tennis. I know I used to be a tennis player. So that's a use of language which is very, very skillful. So say for me, and I just talk about what I practice, so I put in non-resistance, non-anticipation. And those are the two extremes for me of attraction and repulsion, trying to be calm and trying to get rid of. Okay? And so that's my balancing language to not get caught in those hindrances. All right? Non-resistance, non-anticipation. Right? So then if I do that, I see both of those, and I'm able to sustain awareness of change for more sustained periods, samadhi. One way of talking about it. And then energy. So I get the old chakras going if I'm sleepy, and I just relax with the out breath usually if I'm restless. So if I'm restless, I got too much energy, I just out breath. I just work a lot with the out breath. Just with the whole body, yeah, nothing to do, just relax. So those two are a way I work with those two hindrances. And in doubt, I say don't think about it. Very simple. I don't trust thought very much anymore, especially my critical judging mind. So then, okay, so that's the way I've figured out how to do with the five hindrances. But the point of it is, what does your mind get attached to in terms of sankharas, khandhas? Where does your mind, what kind of thinking does your mind get caught up into? And where do you lose track of anicca, dukkha, anatta? And then you have to trust and sustain that awareness for longer and longer periods of time. And if you don't have trust in that, you'll never give it a go. You never do the experiment of, okay, what if I stop trying to figure everything out? Drop trying to understand anything and just sustain awareness of change for an hour. Very hard to do. To keep the mind that pure and present is very, very hard to do. Yeah? And that, you know, that's a kind of samadhi. And then you discover what that leads to. So in terms of like samadhi, and quite often we're just working with the hindrances a lot. And then the rest takes care of itself. So in terms of like jhana and jhana factors, always, you know, the formula you have are, usually the formula you have, you take refuge, Buddha Dhamma Sangha, you pay homage. So that's not just cultural, I think. You know, when you pay homage to the Buddha, you're also paying homage to enlightenment. So you bring up faith. Once you've brought up faith, most of the classical methods of meditation talk about metta bhavana. You should bring up goodwill because of our tendency to be critical or whatever. You bring up goodwill. And those are kind of balancing, energizing factors. So your mind now has faith and openness. That's a big step in itself. Then you choose the object of meditation, and then whenever they talk about the object of meditation, talk about the hindrances. And before they talk about the absorptions and all that, they talk about hindrances. So you're kind of, okay, and then you figure out that package, and then you start to be able to sustain the mind on the object of meditation, whatever it is. And then vitaka vijara, and say the jhana factors, you start to reflect on that, and that's initial and subsequent application of mind. And what is that? What is that? It was saying, well, initial application of mind. I'm going to do the breath. Let's do the breath at the nose. Let's do the right nostril. Whatever. So you choose. And then your mind goes and you choose again. Vitaka vijara. You use language. Breath, viridhamo, breath. You use language, non-resistance, non-anticipation, vitaka vijara, it's thinking, right? It's thinking. And then as you do that, you're able to stay in the present moment, your mind begins to feel happy or peaceful, and your body begins to feel happy and peaceful at different levels, piti sukha. And the whole thing is that you're sustaining these factors, ekagata is one pointedness of mind. Now, one point in a... I'm really answering your question, aren't I? I had to get going, that's all. One pointedness of mind can be pointy in terms of an object, or it can be in terms of presence. That's one pointed. In time. So one pointedness can just be this present moment. I'm in this moment now. And I can reflect on that. Now, when you take like these... If you take something about meditation or samadhi that you have to get and you can't reflect on it, how do you use it? The boss tells you have it or not, but you can't really use that as reflection. It seems to me what really works for me in Buddhism, things that I can reflect on, not things that I have to believe in, because then you have it or you don't have it. But if I can reflect on something, so, okay, how do I use thought? Vitaka vijara. Skillfully, non-resistance, non-anticipation. That's my language, you know, it works for me. So how can you use language to sustain awareness of the way things are in the present moment? And then you start to get the results. You know, the body start, you know, you start to get, you see that like resistance and anticipation create tension in the body and in the mind. And you begin to get the subtlety, letting go of that, and the mind begins to have peace. The body begins to have peace, quite natural, and you're staying in the present moment. So these are all, you know, they're all very, very kind of natural kind of things that you can reflect upon. And doubt is one of the things that comes up in that. And obviously you need awareness. Now, what is awareness? What is pure awareness? Is awareness nibbana? Is it the deathless? Well, not quite. And I think what is there, we don't realize what the depths of awareness are about, let's say it that way. Initially, we know that awareness is important. We don't realize the profundity of what awareness is because we have so much self-identity and self-view around this body and mind. And then as that self-view and self-identity is challenged by witnessing, you start to get the experiences like of emptiness, where the sense of a doer falls away. Me, the one that's always meditating and doing and trying to accomplish something, and you relax into awareness and the doer's gone. And then you see, ooh, awareness is really profound. And those profundities get more and more deep as you go. But you're always just reflecting. You're not trying to achieve anything in that way. And then the achievements come. The things open up quite naturally. Thank you for your question. So in terms of that, these are the classic teachings we have. Mosquito bit me today. These are the classic kind of structures that were offered in Theravada Buddhism. But you really do have to internalize it and figure out what is that, what is this stuff about in my own mind, in my own practice? I can only share with you, what works for me. But do consider, how do you use language, thought, skillfully, rather than just getting rid of thought? I think we know how we use language unskillfully. Blah, 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 right? Moan, 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 complain, 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 or self-disparagement. That's just the addiction to thought. But how do I use thought skillfully? Well, one of the ways I use skillfully is I can analyze a situation and say, well, what's going on? What's the mood of the mind? That's analysis. It's not going into my childhood. It's just a very simple, what's the mood of the mind? Kind of breaking it down, going away from the narrative. That's right thinking. Right understanding, Noble Eightfold Path, you begin with right understanding. And what is right understanding is, well, many ways, but what's the point of the project is to go beyond suffering. And how can I use thought to go beyond suffering? Sammasankappa is the second part of the Noble Eightfold Path. And so you begin to look at thinking, you begin to understand thinking, you see where thinking is obsessive, but you don't just try to get rid of thinking. You learn how to use right thought. Now, right thought is about intention, sammasankappa. Yeah, it's about guiding your mind or directing your mind in a skillful and wholesome way. And that, so we didn't, in Buddhism, no thought is very useful to be able to realize no thought, but also to know how to do right thinking. So in terms of your meditation, you sit down, and then you just ask yourself, what's up? What's up, Vairamba? What's happening? And then you open it, and you just feel the present. You like something, like this, the heater. As soon as I started to meditate, I thought, made a mistake. That was my first perception. Shouldn't have turned it on. So for the next 4 minutes, my mind was saying, should I or shouldn't I? I was watching this sort of, what I guess it's a regret, is it? Oh, wrong decision. As a leader, as a leader of this kind of thing, I'm always making decisions. Things, someone has to do it. So then I'm always, wrong decision. As a follower, you then criticize my decisions. you think, good decision, bad decision. But our minds are just kind of affected in this way. So then I could see, I could just watch my mind, because the criticism had come up, there was a kind of restlessness in my mind. Shouldn't have done that. It was warm enough. Don't like the sound. It wasn't that, it was kind of there. And I just watched that. This is the result. And then I could see that thinking subside, and it was just silent again. So you know how to look at thought as an object of mind. you know how to see, you learn how to see the end of thought. That's very important. Like the end of an emotional whatever, and see the end of an idea, the end of thought. That's a very important space. And then you start to see the beginning of thought, and then you use thought rightly. Right thought, right thinking. So how are you thinking? Right? Is it skillful? Like self-disparagement, when I get on that train of thought, I don't believe it. Because I'm really good at that. I don't know about you. I've got that one developed. We probably all do, right? And it's so convincing. It's so truthful. I mean, it's ultimate truth, right? And yet it's not. You know, it's just a habit of mind. But how often have all of us probably been victimized by our self-disparaging minds? Because it seems so darn real, doesn't it? It seems so real. Obviously, if I murder someone, you know, a bit of regret would be helpful. But, you know, we're really good people. We, you know, we live morally, we work hard and so on, and yet. So that's wrong thinking. And so what, so you notice, oh, this kind of thinking, is it skillful or unskillful? Where does it lead to? Is it helpful or not helpful? So how many, you know, how like in your university training, how many of us got trained in right thinking? Not me. I just had to, you know, you had to get the degree and so on, but no one trained me on all my neurotic thinking. Where's the degree? I'm going to Singapore in January, and I have 4 talks in 4 venues in Singapore. To give a public talk in Singapore, I have to submit a form with my name, passport picture, a title for the talk, and a précis of the talk, and my education. This is embarrassing. I've got a high school education, right? 2 years of engineering, then I dropped out and grew my hair. And so, you know, I'm submitting this now to give a talk in Singapore, and I think the best part of my life, I don't get any credits. And you know, I was thinking about that. What did they teach me in school? They didn't teach me about thought. You know, the Buddha taught me that. My teachers taught me that. That seems much more valuable. You know, that's an aside. But do contemplate thought as an object. Contemplate the mood of the mind, which underlies the thinking. Contemplate how do you let go of obsessive thinking? That's a hard, you know, when your mind gets in a twirl and just kind of keeps chasing its tail. That's horrible, horrible kind of stuff. So when that happens, you have to say, okay, this is an opportunity rather than this is a punishment. Somehow, how can I now, okay, what's the practice now? Sometimes the spinning is around is something, some problem you can't solve or some deep resentment or jealousy or whatever. And the only way I know out of that is body awareness. Right? So the mind starts to spin like worry, obsessive worry. There's no end to obsessive worry. You can really worry if you want. You can really go for it. And there is a necessity to solve problems. But when you get an obsessive cycle like that, body awareness is the thing you start to go to. So then you use thought rather than saying, oh, stop thinking like that. Blah, 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 blah. Stop thinking like that. Blah, 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 blah. Stop thinking like that. That doesn't work. You know, we've all had that, right? And then you wake up and you say, oh, this is obsessive thinking. That's right thinking. You're not saying that I shouldn't think that way. You say, oh, this is obsessive thinking. Okay, finally I'm mindful. And it'll still obsess, but at least you've placed the right thought in there. Okay, now you're grounded. This is right. This is obsessive thinking. Ah, got a bit of distance. Then you make another right thought and you say, where is it in the body? So that's vitaka vijara. You know, you're directing your attention now to a wholesome place. And if you're skilled in body meditation, you get more and more better at the heart chakra. You get more and more, you know, talking with our Thai friends, I think there's a lot of intelligence in the heart chakra. There's a lot of intelligence in your guts. You know, there's a kind of visceral intelligence, which if you allow it to speak, it teaches you things. So as you develop whole body awareness, the mind is obsessing with thought. Oh, okay, what's the underlying mood? That's a right thought. You're not denying, you're not trying to repress, you're just with it. You're really with it. Okay, this is the problem. I'm willing to accept it. I welcome it. Okay, come on up, let's have it. That's metta bhavana. And who wants to welcome the garbage, right? You just want to throw the garbage out, huh? But that doesn't work that way. It's like to incinerate it. It doesn't work that way. You have to release it. So you use metta bhavana. What's metta bhavana? It's accepting the unacceptable. It's welcoming the unwelcome. Right? It's not just about me and granny. It has deeper implications than that. So that's all right thinking, right suggestion. Huh? And then you open up and you feel, well, where is it in the body now? You welcome it. Where is it in the body? And then you wait. That's not an analysis. You wait. No. And so now your attention is on the khandhas. Mindful of the khandhas as they're presenting themselves. And then your mind starts obsessing again. And you get lost for 10 minutes. Right? And then the phone rings and, oh wow, I'm really obsessing. Oh, I shouldn't obsess like this. I gotta stop obsessing. Yeah, just answer the phone, will you? And then no, obsession feels this way. Okay, what's it really like? So you keep coming back to right practice and right attention. And then you figure it out. You figure out how those obsessions work, you release it through the body. That takes time. It takes a lot of work, but it's through right thinking. Wrong thinking is just this constant self, you know, this tyranny of judgment that we have. That's what Lompa Samedo calls it, the inner tyrant. Guilty, you're a dumbo. You ate too much cheese. Or whatever, right? So thinking is a very, very interesting skill to develop. And yet wrong thinking can be very cruel, can it, to ourselves and others. This morning, I usually get up at 4 o'clock. So I got up at 4 o'clock and the kuti was cold and I knew I had to put a fire in my stove. My nose is outside my duvet like this. Guess what my first thought was? I think I'm going to sleep some more. Right? That's comfort. That's the most comfort. You know that feeling? And warm duvet, cold room. And then the second thought was, well, I'm old, I don't need a man, or whatever it was. And the third thought was, get up, Viradumbo, which is a more skillful thought. That's right thinking. Yeah, that's right thinking. What's the mood of the mind? Now, I could have slept in, and then everyone, oh, Bhante, you need more sleep. I said, yeah, you're right, I need more sleep. And I would have played that game. But the result wouldn't have been all that great. Huh? So, right from when you wake up, what's the mood of the mind? What is the thinking mind doing? And I talked about the night before, right? I had the mood of the mind was quite sour. I don't know where it came from. But right from the moment, what's the thinking mind doing? Because the thinking mind is indicating what the mood is. Memory, whatever. You're right with it as much as you can. Save yourself a lot of karma during the day. A part of intelligent or wise life is to forego short-term satisfaction for long-term freedom. We were talking about that the other day. I think any adult has done that. You forego short-term gratification for long-term peace. So that's a very basic kind of. It's not even Buddhist, is it? So short-term satisfaction would have been, oh, another few hours under the duvet, it's good for me. Right? Duvet practice. That's short-term satisfaction. Long-term satisfaction is taking something on, and long-term satisfaction requires giving up some pleasure. So like in meditation, you deal with a lot of displeasure. Discomfort, boredom, right? All kinds of uncomfortable, not hurtful things. But what's the result when you're willing to bear witness to the unpleasant, the uncomfortable, the uninspiring? Just as khandhas arising and ceasing, you begin to have peace. Peace which is not dependent on inspiration, not dependent on comfort, not dependent on beauty, all those things which we love, right? It's not dependent on that. And so quite often the peace that you get in meditation is a strange thing. You'll sometimes go through some really difficult material, right? Restless or yucky or whatever, and you know, I'm just going to witness this now. I'm just going to be with this now. It's just this way now. And you bear witness, and what you're doing is you're going against desire. The desire mind is, get out of here. Get out of here. No, no, I'm going to stay with you. I'm going to be with you. I'm going to watch this. And you stay with it and stay with it, and the desire ceases. And that's why you have the peace. You don't sometimes realize that. You think, well, why wasn't it? It's peaceful now. Why wasn't it peaceful for the meditation? Well, that work created the causes for peace. So when we judge our meditation as being good or bad, that's a bit dangerous. Just let it be what it is. And let it present itself as it is and say, well, this is the way it is now, and see if you can let go of desire, rather than judging this thing or good or bad. So if you have a meditation when you and feel like you weren't getting anywhere, don't believe that. There's nowhere to go. Just see that actually enduring something, some difficult material, is actually building a lot of parami. It's much, much different. It's not just about pleasure. Not about seeking pleasure. Rightio, I think I'll end there. Leave that for your reflection.
Antamayam dhammagataya sadhu karam dadamase.